Hello. Hi, Peter. Thank you for inviting me.
So, how did you come to do what you're doing?
Well, I guess first I have to define what I'm doing. I found my way to Columbia University in 1961, and I went there because there was a fine piano teacher teaching there, and I couldn't find an academic home before then. And as soon as I arrived there, I transferred from a women's college in Virginia. I walked onto the campus, and this is 1961, right, long ago. And on the campus, there were Indians in saris, there were people from Africa in African clothes. And I can still feel the excitement. I have goose flesh when I think of it, because I knew I was home, that it was, the world was there, and that I would not be isolated in the American culture in which I grew up, which I didn't even know that not only did I not relate to it, this was the beginning of rock and roll, if we're thinking of music. I associated that, rock and roll, with the white suburb in which I grew up, which I didn't realize I hated, but I now know I hated. I did not know, couldn't relate to anything there. My parents were into literature and art and somehow found their way into this rich New Jersey town. And I tried hard, like many people do, to fit in as a child and so on. Didn't. At any rate, I wound up at Columbia, and mind you, there were no known supposed women composers of classical music. Even the musicologists at Columbia, who would have seen what I now know, you know, exist in volumes of cantatas and so on, no one ever told me, or anyone else, there was a woman composer. Nonetheless, I took, you know, the undergraduate courses, and no one had told me that I had talent, because no one ever considered a woman to have compositional talent. So I think I made it to junior year before daring to take 16th century counterpoint, because people told me it was really hard. And the guy who taught it, Vladimir Usachevsky, one of the founders of electronic music in this hemisphere, very strict. And I thought, I don't have the intellect to do this, but I had to take an assigned course, you know, required course. So I went into the course. The only woman, everyone else was male, Columbia College, only girl, really. And I was 18. And Vladimir, who I later became his assistant, he could do five-part strict counterpoint in real time on the board, you know, hearing it and being able to sing all the parts. But the first part of that magnificent, to me, course, it was the secret of music for me. And I had spent all of my childhood until that point studying and practicing piano 40 hours a week at that point, really serious. And he gradually, in the species way, which is rarely taught these days, but it's a superb, it is the, to me, best form of teaching Western classical, not Indian, but Western classical. And so gradually, through the first months, we moved through the species, but essentially, he was teaching how to write melody based on notated Gregorian chants and so on. And I could see how it was done. Suddenly, I'm like, yes, I see the arch forms, I see the resolution of the shapes of the melodies, and it was heaven. I knew it was heaven if I could just do this, and I kept doing it. And by the end of that year, he brought into the class singers, four singers, who could read music really well. They were also students, and four instrumentalists and pianists. And they played our works. By that time, we had gone through 18th century forms of counterpoint and so on, and even a little 12-tone versions of counterpoint. And it was the most exciting thing of my whole life, that I was just aghast with pleasure. And I think at that last performance, as it were, class, he turned to the class, all of whom were male except me, and asked, well, who is going to sign up for composition next semester, senior year? And, I had no consciousness that I could sign up for composition. And a bunch of young men around, stuck up their hands. And Vladimir turned to me and said, Alice, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. I am. And he gave me my compositional life by that, because I would never have had the concept. And I've told this story before, but never, I think, recorded. So I owe him, and I tried during the rest of his life to, as a musical father, to give my respect and to help him. So I took that class, I continued in composition, and by the time I was ready to graduate, there were two of us. There was no doctorate at Columbia then in composition, only in musicology. It rarely existed in the U.S. at that point, and Columbia had none. And there was me and Charles Dodge. I don't know whether you've interviewed him, but Charles was one of the very early people in heavy-duty computer music at Bell Labs. And Charles and I were graduating undergrads at the same time. We wanted to go on in composition. There was no doctorate. And so Vladimir and Jack Beeson and a few other composers on the faculty started creating, I guess before that point, they had been trying for me and Charles, who were the first students in the doctoral studies then in composition. They invented the program, fought against Paul Henry Lang and other musicologists who didn't think that composers deserved a doctorate. And indeed, to my mind, if you're going to get a doctorate, you've got to have an intellectual base too, for without question. In my view, history, like musicology, like whatever, ethnomusicology, but formal study as well as craft study. Otherwise, okay, go out and apprentice yourself, and that's fine too. So I eventually, over the heads of the musicologists, apparently Vladimir and Jack Beeson forced through the doctorate by not calling it a PhD, but a Doctor of Musical Arts, and the musicologists finally agreed. So Charles and I were the first students, and then other students came in. And I had already known that I was deeply attracted to writing for voice, particularly for theatrical voice, opera. And in high school, I'd written a few plays, not that anyone cared, but that I was drawn to it, reading and poetry and writing plays. And so when I entered grad school at Columbia, I was already writing scenarios for opera. And so the two parts of my compositional life began, writing for the voice and electronic stuff, because I think already by the time I graduated, I was Vladimir's technical assistant at the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, where later I became associate director. And that's what turned into the Computer Music Center in the 90s, or 80s, late 80s. It just morphed by, title. And then eventually the analog stuff was thrown out and only digital stuff came in. So I was writing for voice. I started studying voice. My sister was formally studying classical voice, and I took from her teacher. And although I'd been a very serious pianist till that point, if you want me to, I'll only concentrate on the computer and electronic stuff. But I write electronic operas too, so So I started studying voice to write better for the voice. And I've quickly realized, my God, I can do this. This is fun. And not only could I learn how to write better for the voice, but I became a professional opera singer pretty fast, too, because no one had to teach me. I already taught, you know, learned the stuff about music and notation and so on. And so 1966, when I was already in grad school, I became opera composer apprentice, the first one in the country with an AGMA union contract. That's the performing artists, you know, singers contract union at the Lake George Opera, where it was the greatest fun. This continued for three different summers while I was in grad school. I sang, first year I sang in the chorus, the succeeding years I sang small parts, and the last year I covered big parts, which was terrifying. But the three different summers, I also conducted, and, you know, they did open rehearsals of my operas that I was working. It was wonderful! Such fun! Just such fun. And what I was writing then was kind of influenced in terms of the words, because I write the words typically, was influenced by, you could call it, avant-garde French theater. I had already done a number of electronic accompaniments to avant-garde theater in Manhattan. My very first professional performance, I guess, was 1966, where I did what really were sound effects. It was supposed to be called music, but I would call it sound effects, for Sam Shepard's first radio plays, which were performed by people like Joseph Chaykin, you know, leading actors. And that was it, you know. So I did a bunch of that for about 15 years here and there off-Broadway. And at the same time, I'm writing operas, and I'm still in grad school, and I was within a year or two teaching one-to-one electronic music at the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center. So I and one other person, also a woman, Pearl Smiley, who never got into computer music, but she did a lot of theatrical electronic, meaning analog, stuff, and very nice pieces. Just, I don't think she ever went on to digital. But Pearl and I, one-to-one, taught most of the Columbia and Princeton students hands-on electronic music from, she was there about a year before me, so me from 1963 on, I was there through like 1980, and during the last few years of that was associate director of the center, as Pearl was too. So we ran the place, put together the concerts, and okay, so during that period, I wrote in terms of electronic music, used my own voice. Since I became a singer, I could easily use that. It was to hand, you know, and created a number of pieces which are on early recordings, such as my piece, The Transformation of Ani, which is based on the Egyptian Book of the Dead, where I took from one section of that work, the hieroglyphs, the physical, the pictorial, you know, the hieroglyphs, and translated each one. Whenever it occurred, I would put the same sound in. This is classical studio techniques in electronic music. So this was splicing, which is an excellent training, I believe, and still should be, people should be trained in it, because the eye, hand, ear coordination by very precise cutting of tape, people learn to hear in a different way than traditional ear training. Their hands are tied to their ear in a different way as a composer, and they don't lose themselves so easily, as my experience is anyway, when they get into digital, where the connection with the body is so diffused, and therefore the emotion is hard to accomplish, in my view. in much music these days. So, let's see. So I did that piece, which is on some of the early classical recordings with other such pieces of Babbitt's and Ussachevsky and Otto Luening and Bulent Arel. These are the pioneers of American electronic music, which I was astonished about 10 years ago to be referred to as a pioneer, you know, in a wagon or something. But anyway, time passes and people call you different things. So, did I hear a question coming?
No.
Okay. Okay, so I'm writing a lot of electronic stuff. Sometimes I take the text, often from high literary sources, which Jack Beeson told me 10 years ago, before he died, something like, you always choose these unpopular texts, you know, like, to me they're fascinating, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Navajo ceremonies, you know, to me, wow, I'd love to know, you know, go into them and absorb and try and learn from them. And, okay, so, a lot of electronic music, most of it involving text or voice in some way. At the same time as I'm writing for acoustic instruments, small operas, trying to get it together. And I got my master's at Columbia in 1967, and then worked on the doctorate, and I was revising. Nobody told me to revise it, and I didn't realize there is a career out there, you know, like you took your time and I could have finished, you know, I didn't need to revise that opera, but it wasn't satisfying to me. So I kept revising and changing it, but I turned it in and in 1975 got my doctorate there and was still so clueless about career. Vladimir asked me when I got my doctorate, did I want to teach? And I remember, and I've never said this on camera, and I said, I don't think I have anything to teach. And in some sense, that's true of everyone, I know. But now I know no one else does either. Then, okay, I didn't know that no one else did. I assumed they looked so confident that they must, right? Or I'm sorry if I'm, you know, speaking wrongly about people out there. I think we're all in the same boat, but those of us who study really hard, and I have in my life with great pleasure, even hunger, you know, those of us, we can teach something, you know, to another human being. There's something to offer. Anyway, now I know that's gone too late. So I was at the same time becoming a professional opera singer. And at that time, since no one had ever heard of supposedly a woman composer, nowadays they're women scholars. So in the last 30 years, they have resurrected the works that always existed by Hildegard von Bingen or, you know, any number of Renaissance and Baroque types. Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, who was, the most published cantata composer of her time, the favorite composer, not courtesan, of Louis XIV. Anyway, no one knew them then, even though the huge volumes existed in the libraries. And the, you know, specialty libraries, because they weren't copied anymore. Now they are, thank God. Okay, so as I became an opera singer, this is in the 70s or late 60s through the 70s, no one had heard of a woman composer. And anyway, opera singing then and now, the most cutthroat possible thing other than, I don't know, being a composer in classical music. And you didn't give anybody, you know, any data that they might use against you. So only a few conductors knew that I was a composer. And of course, I would come to the rehearsals knowing the score and taking detailed notes and stuff. And loved it. But some physical problems happened to me in around 1980, and a couple of years went by, and you can't resume your career. So that ended, but while I did it, I sang with the New York City Opera, medium, small roles, a few, and with the Washington National Opera, which is now, called the National Opera, and other such companies, and some abroad in Italy. This is straight traditional opera, though I did a number of contemporary works, 12-tone and otherwise, and I challenged 12-tone composers to memorize 3 hours of music with no score. You walk on stage, you get your cue. I did it, but it taught me something, too, about, and I'm no slouch as a study, as a student of, you know, learning a score, but there are physiological, neurological reasons why that's so hard and why audiences, in my view, don't go for it. And that gets into a third thing, which I might get into, which is my work in psychology of music on the side. Okay, so I'm singing, I sang, I guess the most pleasurable stuff I sang was in Renaissance, early Renaissance opera, Monteverdi particularly. I had to cover Penelope in Il Ritorno d'Ulisse in Patria, City Opera, and that was Frederica von Stade, so I had to cover her because we looked kind of alike, same size, I guess our costumes, the costume worked too, and same, similar voice, mezzo. Mine was louder voice, but her beautiful voice, of course. And in Italy, I sang the first performance in 300 years of Medea in Cavalli's Giassone, which is a comedy. And that was challenging, singing Italian, Renaissance Italian, to an Italian audience. Got good reviews. I had to work real hard on the language. But the bliss of the high form, the texts were by major poets at the time, not like most 19th century opera texts, and particularly Monteverdi's, you know, so that it was like high theater, like straight theater, which I've been involved in here and there, and not like the downsizing of the value of many words in 19th century opera, certainly including Wagner, which I had to sing too. So my singing career, my favorites were really early opera because of the beauty of certainly Monteverdi's music is just amazing. But the text, the profundity and beauty of the poetry. And I sang, because it was appropriate for my voice, Wagner a little. I did one of the little Walküres, Rosweisse, in Washington with Antal Doherty, and it was fantastic because you're on stage and the horns point right at you. You get the sound. It's like ecstasy. The best. You're right there. Anyway, that was fun, and I had to sing Orchard and some other Strauss in addition to Der Komponist. I think I'm the first time since, who was it, Pauline, someone or other, I forgot her last name, in the 19th century, who actually did write some music on the side. She was, of course, not allowed to be fully trained, but she sang similar roles as me. And then, I'm sure someone, but I think I might be the first woman who ever sang the composer in Strauss's Ariadne, who was a composer first before being a singer. And that was fun. It's a hard piece, but it's a fun thing, you know, to play a composer. And I realized, I'll start talking about electronics in a minute, because I guess that's why I'm supposed to be here, but or computer stuff. But part of the pleasure, or even the fear of playing Der Komponist, was I actually acted this role. This is a real role in my life, which is, in Strauss's character, as you may know, it's sort of modeled after his imitation of someone like Mozart, you know, who was into art and only art, and can't understand the ways of the world and how producers have to downgrade everything just for money. And essentially that happens to the character in the opera. And by God, I realized, and since then I've seen it many times in my life, same thing. I'll be devoted to some high ideal in text. A more recent version was Chaucer's Troilus and Crusade, which I created an opera of 2008 that City Opera did parts of in Middle English the first time. There's only one other classical piece really in Middle English. This is a whole opera. I rewrote the text the plot using Middle English. Why am I bringing that up? I got a point. At any rate, oh yes, because of the idealism and seeking after transformation through art. Personal, my own, and ideally others. And there aren't too many people I've known who would die for that, you know? And there's the character, and I'm playing it, and it's a male character in the opera. Pants roll, of course, for mezzo. And he's being treated in the opera as one is treated in the real world, which is, oh no, don't do that, it won't sell. It won't, you know, it's too highfalutin. It's too intellectual. Or what are you doing that for? That's ancient literature. And, you know, I'm stunned because that's what I love, at any rate. So part of my opera career was enlightening me in that way. Okay, so I'm writing by the early 80s, I'm finally writing. I've been doing vocal stuff with electronics, trying to put together a real opera with electronics. And by 1987... I completed this opera called Shaman, which was based on traditions of North American shamanism, Native American stuff. And I wrote the text with my brother-in-law, who's also a poet, Ed Barrett. I got him involved too, and it made it better. He's a real poet. And that is electronic with voices. And it was performed by this fine company that apparently doesn't exist now, the American Chamber Opera Company, which was formed and directed and conducted by a guy from Colombia. Oh, God, I'm forgetting his name. Forgive me, I'll remember in a minute. And they put it on, and it ran for, I don't know, 5-6 performances, and it was reviewed by the Times and other things, and it worked. It was really scary. The singers, because of the place it was being performed in, which doesn't exist now, I think it was called the Tomy Theater. This is 1987 in Manhattan. The acoustics were superb, so the singers did not have to be mic'd. This is one of my problems aesthetically at the moment with computer music or digital music or any form of electronic music. If you have live performers, almost always the acoustics demand that you mic the performer. That changes the timbre. But in order to have the sound emerge from the same place, doesn't really work with most acoustical circumstances without the sound of the live performer also emitting from wherever the loudspeakers are. And this changes timbre. It is extremely irritating to me aesthetically, nonetheless. Anyway, so going back, first electronic opera was Shaman in 1987. Parts of that were recorded on Opus One Records. Later electronic operas, and I brought some excerpts from them, were Mass for the Dead, which is an opera based on the Requiem Mass in Latin, has some Greek in it too, old Greek, some Sappho, some other stuff. And that was reviewed by the Times as the scariest thing in New York that year, no one awarded me the Guggenheim or the Pulitzer for it, for getting a scary piece, but it worked. Hasn't been done since, and I go on to other projects and don't market my stuff, being into the next thing I'm creating. That piece, then came Apocalypse, which is recorded on CRI, now New World Records. That's an electronic opera for three voices, electric guitar and tape. And that, like Mass for the Dead, is already MIDI technology combined with analog transformational techniques, because the machine still existed at Columbia, even though by the 80s I was no longer formally working there. I, like other people, just kept, other composers, no one told us to leave, and I just kept creating my works there, electronic stuff. So that MIDI era began. So late 80s, my stuff, a lot of MIDI technology starts coming in, because it's easier to do precise pitches without working your tail off. But I still used, in those two operas, which are long, the, to me, wonderful possibilities of the classical analog studio, where, as Vladimir taught, and then I taught other people, if you set up, you know, you have something you want to transform with timbral and other variations, you set up a number of timbral transforming physical, you know, machines to slightly change the pitch and the time at which that will come in. This is way beyond what you can do with preset digital stuff. You can do it if you work your tail off in software synthesis, but I frankly haven't heard anyone working their tail off in that particular way. Much easier to do, though no one was doing it either with analog. Takes a long time. So I would set up a pre-recorded voice, such as in my opera Apocalypse, a baritone, and the baritone could sing live. I would have pre-recorded, he would have to sing. Now you could do it with Max MSP live to adjust to the live performer in time, but then the live performer would have to keep coordinating to a preset time on the tape. But they could do it, a good performer, and if you wrote the right rhythms where it's bodily enough so the performer could feel the musicality and the shape of the thing coming in. And these transformations would be preset, which is what I prefer to do still when I write digital music. I am bored by stuff that's live usually, because it can never be as carefully set or designed moment to moment in great detail. I just prefer that. To the slight degree you lose in by having it pre-recorded, the slight degree you lose in terms of the performer's initiation of events. I'd rather initiate events myself. I've studied my whole life to initiate events, and they can follow me. Even though that's what a composer does to me. So, okay, those two operas, there are others. There are lots of things I wrote for dance, including in the 2000s, three pieces, one year after another, for the very fine choreographer, Mark Taylor, who at that point was in Pittsburgh. He ran the Dance Alloy Company, and one of the pieces he and I did together, oh, I should mention before then, well, one of those pieces called Dust. I'll go back and explain how I got into that. For 10 years in the 1990s, I studied, which meant every day, Indian classical music in the following mode. Bharatanatyam is classical Hindu dance drama. The texts are very old. They're usually Sanskrit, Telugu, Tamil, some Tamil. And they are on traditional stuff. So around 1990, I guess it was, I found someone in New York, because more Indian artists were then coming. India doesn't support any more than this country, even less its classical artists, which is a tragedy. It's one of the great traditions of the world. So they're coming here more and more. They tour. And I found this superb Bharatanatyam dancer, which means dancer musician, because they know the music too. And so for the first couple of years of study with her, which eventually was every day lessons in the traditional way, I learned the dance steps. Those are rhythms. They're very complex, as one could imagine. And after a couple of years, she threw me on stage. I'd already been an opera singer in the past, of course, and could present myself okay on stage. Was never a dancer, but I could act. And just like in Western opera, I was assigned the role, because I was taller than most of the Indians who were the professional dancers, the role of the dying kings, the trouser roles again. Also because I could do stuff, you know, acting without the heavy footwork that the true dancers could do. And that is heavy footwork, way beyond ballet, the postures. So I did that for a while, and then she felt I knew enough, and she threw me in with the musicians. And mind you, at the same time in my other life, at the time I'm writing other pieces, electronic music of various sorts, but I'm studying this stuff and then performing it with her and her company at places like Asia Society and Wesleyan University, Juilliard, and so on. And so she threw me in with the musicians. So I performed for a number of years for her. The position of, it's called in Bharatanatyam, Natuvangam, which meant it's the role that the composer plays in Bharatanatyam. They invent these choreographic patterns that the dancer then applies within these categories of choreography. They intersect with the drummer, who have different syllables. And so, because my teacher was the lead dancer, there was no chance that I would throw her off. But usually in India, the composer recites these syllables. And I got a chance to work with one of them, who spoke no Western language when he came to New York. He was one of the traditional families, you know, for hundreds of years only doing this. And he could do it like that, these incredibly difficult patterns. They're woven around tala, you know, but he could do it in real time. So I got a chance to see a traditional oral tradition. This is oral in words, oral in dance, oral in drama, and in music. And these are expert people who have studied their whole lives from early childhood. And I got a chance to see how we've lost it in the West, of course. Traditional epic poetry doesn't exist. Traditional music that's not notated in the classical tradition doesn't exist, except in jazz now. So it really does work. Anyway, so I was thrown on stage with the musicians doing this stuff for a number of years, and deeply appreciate that form of drama, which is so codified, so yet there are interactional things. So in my own operas since the 90s, and every one of my works, because I now am heavily influenced by Rag, I don't try to change the tuning system, but I'm so used to the patterns of particularly North Indian raga, which I was also studying at the same time. And that is really why I went after it. So in my computer works, that exists too. And it's much, so going into the computer stuff more, I use now, after MIDI, I find MIDI very dull, but it has its purpose. When I write non-electronic stuff, I use Finale, of course. Finale and Sibelius are the most usual notation programs that are used amongst people my generation. And so, of course, I use them. When the technology I now have access to, because I'm no longer, oh, I should explain. During the 90s, late 87 or so, when MIDI was really just coming in, I started dropping in on the computer music class right before Brad started teaching there. And then when Brad took over, I started sitting through, and I think he liked my sitting through because I'm experienced in the class, and picked up from him, from his teaching, you know, the technology, and particularly C Sound and C Mix, and which are deeply pleasurable to use and were then during the 90s, because he brought in the next computer, which now doesn't exist. But with that, oh, I loved using it, but because you could tweak it in the similar way as you could analog equipment. You mentioned before, Peter, when we were talking before recording, I guess, that you could have, you know, use things in the way they weren't designed. You said something like that. Yes, indeed. Not abusing them, but that's one of the things that's enjoyable about classical analog studio techniques. You play with the instrument to see what it can do, and that often isn't quite what it was designed to do. In fact, it can be very different, but the sounds can be interesting. Likewise, digitally, I enjoyed using the next computer more than anything since then, because you could go down to the number level, just tweak it one number right there, you know, in a row of numbers that had parameter meanings and sound, and see what effect, very similar, very close to playing, experimenting in a musical way in the analog studio. And so I wrote part of Mass for the Dead using those techniques, and within a few years the next computer was stopped. It wasn't made anymore. Columbia got other ones, and by that time, let's see, I think all the analog equipment, which was designed at Columbia, much of it by James Seawright, who was one of the first electronic sculptors, wonderful character, Jim's still around, who then became head of the arts department, art at Princeton after he left Columbia. But he designed with Peter Mose, who's one of the engineers, he's still alive, he's still around. He, Jim, and Virgil de Carvalho, who Paul Lansky, who taught computer music at Princeton, once said, you know, was one of the great creative geniuses as an engineer, and a wonderful human being, Virgil. And they built the stuff. This was top of the line, you know, in every form. The sound was superb. You can't get equipment like that. It's handmade, like a handmade violin. You know, no distortion, hardly anything. Nothing compared to what you can buy. Top of the line. At any rate, doesn't exist now. Most of it isn't there. And, okay, 1994, 95, Mario Davidovsky left Columbia. He was then director, went up to Harvard thereafter, and I offered my services as director of development because the place was completely moribund. Nothing was happening. There was only one class like a week there, no concerts. Nobody was invited to write music. Vladimir, during his years, he retired in 81 or 2, had invited people from all over the world. That's why that place was the seminal place to be in the 60s and 70s. Everyone was there. There was even an African composer there in the 60s, serious composer. People from South America, people from Japan. That didn't exist in the 60s. This was a meeting of exciting individual, you mentioned individualistic, everyone's style was different. You could recognize that person didn't write this, they wrote that. It was such individuality. Part of it was being the 60s, people were allowed not to conform. And the impulse, which I think is multifaceted, to conform, part of it is to get jobs, because there are certain reasons why that happens, teaching job. Okay, so I enjoy deeply getting involved in CSound to some extent. I'm no programmer, but I'm very good at playing with equipment, including digital, if the equipment is tweakable, enjoyable, you know, change something, listen, change, listen, I like that, I'll do more of that. So after that point, then home computers came in and I got a Mac, and for various reasons, I was no longer going up to Columbia. I became, I should say, director of development at the center and brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars for the center. It did not disappear, and I do believe I had a lot to do with that, so it survives, thank goodness, and left. I had asked for a position there, did not follow through, and so I left. So since then, I've been using a Mac and using, to some degree, CSound, a little bit of CMix, but it continuously changes. And I'm a composer. I have no interest in instrument development, whether it's analog or digital. You have something, I'll write a piece for it. You keep changing it, I'll write a piece for whatever I know how to use. You know, I'm not going to go through learning 9 million things which are never relevant to anything else. That's what I see as one of the problems digitally now. So I'm using Pro Tools when I need to write an electronic piece. In the last several years, I've written several analog operas. They are not digital. The one I'm working on now, which I've almost finished, the Center for Contemporary Opera is supposed to perform this year. I think they're going to do it. They're, of course, looking for funding. And that is called Zhao Jun, A Woman of Peace, and it's built... It's a piece about nonviolence, and I've taken the text, adapting it from Tang Dynasty poems, which they were going through the same horrible Weltanschauung that we are, you know, violence and war everywhere, destruction of the environment everywhere, only now it's over the whole world. Then it was over the civilized part of China. So that's what I'm working on. It's for two singers and three instruments, because that's what is now being funded. And I should mention recent electronic works. Some of them are available. I have one album on Albany Records called Shenandoah, and that's two digital pieces for dance for Mark Taylor, and one piece called Vegetable Karma, which uses voices and is kind of Tibetan-influenced and hip-hop-influenced in a weird way. And then a recent piece, I wrote two pieces for the superb trombonist Monique Bouzarté in 2004 and 2008, and one of them is called Miarritza, Requiem for Rachel Corey, who was, as you may know, the American 23-year-old peace worker who was killed in Israel in 2003, mown down in full sight by an Israeli forces bulldozer. And I heard her mother speak on WBAI radio in New York, and I couldn't believe, if I had such a daughter, and I don't, you know, destroyed for helping people, that's a hard thing. So I wrote that piece for her that has heavy-duty CSound in it and pluck algorithms and things. And then my more recent electronic piece is 2008, I wrote Kyriel for violin and computer music, pre-recorded. That's now out, recorded by the fine violinist Eiji Yoshioka on, what is it, Koch International, yeah. And that's a 12-minute piece devoted to, like many of my recent works, the great goddess, whatever local variety. This one is Kuan Yin, the Chinese variety. So that's sort of recent. You have any other questions you want me to talk about? Or?
Well, you threatened to talk a bit about psychology and music.
Oh, thanks. Okay.
We have some time. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. Well, another of my deviations from remunerative work was during the 1980s. For about 10 years, I was formally studying psychoanalysis and kind of and definitely practicing it on the side, usually in the form of trying to help creative people, doing a variety of things, including workshops on stage fright here and there, and particularly dream work to help people, not just with stage fright, but with creative generation. And that I was okay at. Doing psychotherapy, forget it. Certainly not in that mode. Wasn't good at it. But that led me into much more detailed reading and interest in how does music communicate? How does it communicate emotion? And so I started doing intensive reading, and I could find no relevance in the forms of psychotherapy that existed. Certainly no relevance in Freudian psychoanalysis to, you know, what was it communicating? And I began reading in animal cross-special psychology and behavior, animal behavior, most particularly mammalian behavior, and began to see that there was work in this area, and found the work of the neuroscientist Manfred Kleins, who also has a master's from Juilliard in piano. He's a fine concert pianist. He himself studied with Pablo Casals. He's about 10 or more years older than me. And read his work eagerly. Eventually was having one or two little tiny articles published in something called, one book called Psychoaesthetics, which I wrote about his work in a cursory kind of way. And I got a copy of the book and sent it to him. And when he was next in New York, met him with utter delight. The man is an absolute genius. And he invited me to speak once at the International Society for Research on Emotion, which was then held that year at Rutgers. And I got to meet these amazing people who, like Paul Ekman, the world's expert on facial communication, and anthropological biologists, you know, real people who deal in factual or documentable stuff, which is so hard in music, and you can't see sound, you know. And so I started applying his work to music, Manfred Kleins, which is spelled C-L-Y-N-E-S, and lectured on it a bunch at the Santa Fe Opera a number of years. I would be brought in to speak before, like, their premiere of their production of Wozzeck, and that was fun to speak to intelligent, you know, audiences, but who are not specialists either in music or psychology necessarily, but the true classical music audience, and also taught a course on it at NYU, which was very challenging because it should have been a grad course, but the guy who had me do it there, who was in charge of scheduling classes, wanted the clinical psych people to have it as an elective, but then he realized they have no electives. They have so many assigned courses. So he put it in as a upper-level undergrad course which some of the students were sort of prepared for, but it crosses too many boundaries to be easily comprehensible to people who haven't read enough in certain areas, such as phonology and linguistics. You don't have to have all the terminology, but the approach of listening, animal behavior techniques, and animal communication techniques. So, okay, I did the best I could. I haven't taught it since then because it doesn't pay to teach adjunct. It's an enormous abuse. But I hope I can compile a list of my lectures into a book before I pass out of the picture. And I would love to work, if I ever am not working on another opera, I would love to find an appropriate biologist or animal behaviorist of some sort to refine these things with, and to work particularly with primate vocal patterns, which there are really, really some fruitful areas there. I know I could explore with an appropriate scientist who has that other set of, you know, background and skills, and then apply it to what I can bring from music. These patterns are there. They, without question, Manfred Klein's found a lot of them. These are specific, particularly pitch patterns that communicate. It's never taught in academia, very interesting, that communicate specific emotions. And I've been trying to refine these, if anyone wants to know, call me, with how does timbre interact with these profiles, melodic profiles? How are more subtle or mixed emotions created? But they're there. And they are cross-cultural to a certain degree, just as linguistic patterns in phonology are cross-cultural to a certain degree. They're partially biological, partially neural. Anyway, that's my other interest. If I had another life, I'd love to pursue it more. And I wish that academia was set up now, because I love academia in a way. And like you, Peter, and when we were talking before, I've never fit in because I don't stop, and I'm not in a box, and I don't mean to accuse other people of being in boxes. All I know is that open research beyond musical notation, beyond, I don't know. All I know is I love to explore these things. I know I've found things, and there's no place for me. And I love these places. What's wrong with them? You know, maybe I'm just being, I don't think so, arrogant. I love to explore, and it feels like academia is not open to the degree I wish it were. And that's the case also for Manfred Klein, I must say. He was at the university in Australia, at Sydney, where he was given a lab, not in this country. He's an American. He was not given a lab. His work is not covered. In fact, psychology of music is hardly ever taught anywhere. Isn't that weird? Isn't it strange? Wouldn't one want to know? At any rate, so if he has no place, well, okay, I can face it. I have no place, too. I mean, to talk to the man, I saw him. Manfred, I don't know if you'll ever see this little review of mine, but watching him give a lecture at Juilliard, this must have been, you know, more than 10 years ago, Juilliard students came in. He is a genius, so he is not relaying, you know, like one would hope a teacher could relay your past work and explain. He's into what he's doing at this very moment. He's thinking up new stuff. And if you listen carefully, you can hear it's bubbling out of him. And he's like a traditional teacher in India. You do not question. You should just listen. There's something happening that you can learn from. But I knew that these fine students, Juilliard, you know, wonderful performers, they couldn't identify what he was because they didn't know his previous work, and he wasn't going to explain it. He was like an oracle speaking the new thing. And I could hear it, you know, and wanted to take notes and stuff. And I guess that doesn't sound real to people. Can't they hear it? It was so exciting for me. But other people and other new disciplines knew what he was. People from Europe, big scientists, would come to these meetings and listen and read his stuff and collaborate with him, but not in music. What a loss, my goodness, what a loss. At any rate, great joy from exploring those things for me. And I wish I could find my way beyond just writing music, which is a great joy too, but I would like to pursue that if I can, find the right persons to work with. And they would only be in academia. But at the moment, I'm not in academia, so there you are. But that's great stuff, psychomusic.
Thank you.